Cresta in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
With the New York Times in one hand and the Catechism of the Catholic Church in the other, Al Cresta is ready for conversations of consequence.
America is as divided as it has been in 150 years.
Politics is symptomatic of the culture.
They don't have a personal relationship with Christ.
We've been sacramentalized, but not evangelized.
Why should Washington listen to us when our own house is in disarray?
The church's greatest riches are her people.
Share the contagious joy of being a friend of Christ.
Story after story after story of people who have had inexplicable healings.
Broadcasting from the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and taking a closer Catholic look at current events, issues, and ideas. This is Cresta in the Afternoon.
That's beautifully said, Al.
Thanks for your voice for liberty.
It's like a homecoming each time on your program. It's
clear to me that you've thought these things through at a deep level.
Let's build the church, and then we'll bless the nations.
Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. We continue in Grand Rapids at Acton University. Socialized medicine, something which we've heard a great deal of discussion about during the debate over the Affordable Care Act. Throughout history, Christian institutions have been huge providers of medical care, but there wasn't much talk about the role of the church in providing medical care, in spite of the fact that Catholic institutions, but other Christian institutions, are also, throughout the world, large deliverers of health care. Most countries have a pluralistic system of health care in which Christian institutions play a role. But increasingly, there are political movements that favor socialized, single-payer systems, state involvement such that Christian institutions are pushed to the sideline. We're going to talk with Philip Booth about socialized medicine. Does it work anywhere? And if so, is there something we can learn from that? Also coming up in this first hour, we'll be taking a look at Judaism, the state and limited government. The idea of limited government, believe it or not, finds its root in the Hebrew Scriptures. So we'll look, what does the Bible teach about the nature and scope of the state? What have the rabbinic attitudes been towards political authority? And what, if anything, do the answers to these questions mean for the modern state of Israel? We'll talk with Dr. Daniel Mark, Orthodox Jew, who's given a great deal of thought to these questions. Now, next hour, we're going to spend with Dr. Samuel Gregg, Director of Research for Acton Institute. Sam has written an extraordinary book called Reason, Faith, and the Struggle for Western Civilization. It's a book very much aware of the problems we face, their origin, but it's also a book of extraordinary hope. First, though, the headlines.
Thank you, Al, and good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Friday, June 21st. It's the memorial of Aloysius Gonzaga. And today's news is brought to you by Charity Mobile, supporting pro-life and Catholic causes at charitymobile.com. President Trump is talking about his thinking before calling off retaliatory airstrikes against Iran. During an interview for NBC's Meet the Press, Trump said a plan was ready to go, subject to my approval.
And things would have happened to a point where you wouldn't turn back or couldn't turn back. So they came and they said, sir, we're ready to go. We'd like a decision. I said, I want to know something before you go. How many people will be killed? In this case, Iranians.
He noted that he pulled back after military officials told him there would be about 150 Iranian deaths at three designated sites in Iran. Trump said he didn't think it was proportionate to shoot down an unarmed drone. Iran shot down an unmanned U.S. military drone over the Straits of Hormuz this week. U.S. immigration officials will reportedly start conducting massive roundups of migrant families on Sunday. Several reports say ICE agents are targeting up to 2,000 families that have been slotted for deportation in several big cities. The cities include Los Angeles, Chicago, Miami, and Houston. And a new study shows that smartphones may be linked to horn-like structures growing on the inside of people's skulls. The Scientific Reports study found bone spurs on the base of skulls of around 400 adults. Bone spurs occur when inflammation damages the cartilage and the body tries to repair it by growing more bone. The study resurfaced after BBC published an article last week on how modern life is transforming and changing with technology use. Scientists say extensive screen time, bending the head down for extended periods of time, and poor posture may be the cause of the physiological change. With your Ave Maria Radio News, I'm Dan McGraw.
Good afternoon, I'm Al Cresta, and we continue here in Grand Rapids, Michigan at 2019 Acton University. With me, Dr. Jay Bruce. He's Associate Professor of Philosophy at John Brown University. He writes and thinks at the intersection of philosophy, theology, politics, and economics, interdisciplinary thinker. He's the author of Rights in the Law, The Importance of God's Free Choices and the Thought of Francis Turretin. He's working on a new book, Exploring Christianity and Equality, and serves as assistant pastor at Covenant Church, and that's in what?
Fayetteville, Arkansas. Yeah.
Well, it's good to have you here.
Thank you so much, Al. I appreciate it.
Should I address you as Jay?
Yes, please.
Okay. The idea of legislating morality, this is one of those, there are certain popular cliches that have a life of their own after a while. One of them is, you can't legislate morality. And, of course, if you stop and think about it, it's really pretty silly.
Exactly.
But what people mean by that is that there's a certain types of behaviors they don't think the law can get at. But let's just deal with the blunt phrase. You can't legislate morality. You meet somebody on the street, and they say that to you.
So what I would say is when we're talking about legislating morality, and you got to the heart of the issue, people say we can't legislate morality. But what they really mean is, on this little particular contested position, maybe their own private vice, they say, well, we can't legislate morality. Blanket statement is really, we're talking about marijuana.
Right.
My point in the lecture that I gave is that legislating morality is appropriate because we can exercise our political status. We can give moral guidance and have a moral voice to each other. It's actually required because we can and must, as a matter of principle, we do make some things illegal simply and only because they're immoral. There was a craze in the bars in Florida where they would take little people and put helmets on them, and then they would throw them as far as they could. It's called dwarf tossing, and it was made illegal. And the reason why it was made illegal is because it's wicked. People are not footballs.
That's right.
And so even if they're willing participants, they're getting well paid, the drunks in Florida are having a great time, we still made it illegal merely and only because it's immoral. And then I also argue that it's inevitable that if you say, well, what's the alternative? We're just going to protect rights. That's all we're going to do. And one of the things that I say is there's always conflict between rights.
Right.
So when we consider abortion, are we talking about a right to privacy or a right to life? So there are conflicts between the rights that kind of mask or shield the fundamental moral questions. Then there are conflicts about the rights themselves. So private property, but is it intellectual property or is it, you know, if you're Joel Saladin, he was here a couple of years ago and he actually tells the story of how there was a neighbor that had genetically modified crops and they blew into his crops and hybridized. And the company that had patented the genetically modified crops came after him because they wanted royalty payments. So it's all property rights. Does he have a property right to protect his field or do they have intellectual property? These are going to be resolved by fundamental moral questions.
Yeah.
And then finally, there are conflicts about the nature of rights themselves. Do I have a right because of my personhood or agency? Is it an agency that I have actually right now that I'm exercising, or is it something that I potentially have? These are all, you know, behind the pristine language of rights are deep moral questions. And then finally, I like to argue that it's actually dangerous to think otherwise. You know, people always throw up the totalitarian specter.
Sure.
Right? Oh, if we go the legislating morality approach, then we're just going to become Iran.
Right.
But I like to point out that I like to ask people, was early America totalitarian? No. But if you look at some of their laws, like of the Massachusetts Bay Colony, then they just say, this is wrong. Why? Because the Bible says.
That's
so
right.
They quote a Bible verse.
Yeah.
And then I like to point out that
John Cotton's abstracts.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
So in Utah, I've never been to Utah. Have you been to Utah?
No, I might have flown in there once. I've never walked around.
I've read, but I haven't experienced, that if you order a cocktail in Utah, that they have to, that the server will walk away from you and go behind a screen or a curtain that they've erected to protect the children from seeing a cocktail mixed. And I like to point out that if it's dangerous for a kid to see a cocktail mixed, isn't it even more dangerous to see a gin and tonic drunk? You know, but anyway, I like to point out that this is a weird law. I think it's a weird law. I wouldn't vote for it. But it's a free country, and people have a right to organize themselves in a way that's sensible and appropriate to them. And then the kicker is, but if you want to go to the libertarian nirvana of us being able to sell a spare kidney on the open market, the only place that you can do that in the world, quote unquote, legally is Iran, which, by the way, really is totalitarian, right? So anyway, that's my argument in a nutshell.
That's one more reason I don't like Iran. They can sell kidneys on the open market. But this is an important point that the United States has had many laws over the years on the books that today we would find inhibiting. You know, I don't recall when I was growing up in Connecticut. Most of the stores were closed on Sunday.
Yes.
And I don't remember if there was a law on the books or not, but I know in some states they actually had laws on the books which forbade commercial transactions on Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that wasn't a totalitarian government. That was people thinking that this was a way they wanted to organize their lives together.
Exactly.
And the problem is when you begin to have one of the problems you come across is when former shared values and former common morality begins to break down and you have widespread dissent. I mean, the Puritans, again, in the Massachusetts Bay Area and the Congregationalists in Connecticut, learned that within a generation or so.
Exactly.
You know? So this is a how should Christians look at the inevitable dissent from laws that previously had been accepted as just common sense?
Well, I think that one of the major problems that we have in the country is that, and I would argue that because we have this rights-only approach, don't legislate morality, instead of laws being made by the people and their representatives, laws are actually made by the Supreme Court of the United States.
Yeah.
So in the case of gay marriage, it was a 5-4 decision.
Unbelievable, yeah.
And whereas in the good state of Arkansas, the good people of Arkansas voted to legalize marijuana. I voted against it. Yeah. I voted against it for moral grounds, mm-hmm. but also I thought it was just ugly constitutional law. They amended the state constitution, and I forget exactly the wording, and hopefully they've changed it, but it was like, Bubba and Boudreaux are going to run the marijuana dispensaries. And I'm thinking, just as a matter of constitutional law, this is just ugly, right? Yeah. You know, to write people into the Constitution.
Sure.
But the point here is that I know that I lost to my neighbors and my colleagues and people, friends. I know that there were people that I know that I think are respectable people that said, yeah, we should legalize marijuana. Whereas with the Supreme Court, you'll be surprised to learn, I don't know any of the justices.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, that's right.
And so I think that the ability, and also America's a big country, so the ability to legislate morality locally, and then if you don't like it, you can move to a new place. I think what's most egregious, and you'll know the history better than I will, but if I remember correctly, Rob Koons is at the University of Texas at Austin. Mm-hmm. I heard him talking about how when Ave Maria moved to Florida, they basically took, you know, swampland or whatever and made a city.
Yeah.
And so you've got these people who are self-consciously conservative Catholics who are saying, this is a place that we want to build and this is a community we want to build.
Right.
And so they then had some kind of law on the books where it was like, and I forget what it was, but it was like, We want to make it so that you can't buy or consume or whatever really bad pornography.
Right.
really, you know, it's something that everybody would say is egregious. And of course, I don't know what the level, but the court struck it down.
Yeah.
Because, you're in. And so Rob's position is, and I like this, as long as you're not keeping people in the community, right? There's a right to leave.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah,
you know,
right.
You know, you don't have to live
right to
in that. Yeah. And then, yeah, so I think that's a way to handle dissent, is that you're losing to the people that you know.
This is interesting. So, I mean, I like that because it lets everybody know that we're all engaged here in kind of an experiment in living. And we have to ask, how ought we to order our lives together? And the question is, who's the we in we the people here? Who's
exactly.
the are? Who
exactly.
are we really? What's the limits of our association?
That's right. And I keep the Christian Sabbath, so I don't work. Yeah. I mean, I do church work, but I don't.
Sure.
Sunday's a day of rest.
Right.
But if I was voting on a law to prohibit people from working on a Sunday, I probably would look around, just to your point. I would think, you know what? What? And this is a very Thomistic point. What kind of state intrusion are we going to need to enforce this kind of law?
Right.
And I'm thinking even in Arkansas, you would have to have onerous state power. So I probably would say, I can't vote, right. even though I want everybody to keep the Christian Sabbath.
That's right.
I don't want the state to make people keep, police officers at houses.
Yeah.
Like, why aren't you in church?
We have to remember that when we pass a law, what we're saying is we're willing to use force to get compliance.
Exactly.
And so we should always ask, is this something I think we should use force?
Exactly.
To get compliance.
And I think that people, the average person on the street, though there is no average person on the street, but I think the average person on the street is a lot more intelligent and responsive to counsel than we would recognize. So in the state of Pennsylvania, in the early part of the history, they had a statement that said you had to believe in the Old and New Testament in order to hold state office. Mm-hmm. And a Jew wrote and said, do you realize this is keeping Jews out of office? And I just need to know, should I tell all my Jewish friends who are thinking of immigrating to America to go to New York or to come to Pennsylvania? They changed the law.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
they changed the law.
They didn't realize. Oftentimes there's unintended consequences.
Exactly.
We do well by saying, hey, wait a minute, guys. Is this really what you meant?
Exactly.
Right. Well, thanks so much. How do people stay in touch with you? I know you have a lot of jobs that you do.
Yeah.
How do people stay in touch
with you? So I'm on Twitter at James E. Bruce.
Okay.
And people can always email me at jbruce@jbu.edu.
Okay.
And I'd be happy to hear from your listeners.
Great.
Yeah.
We'll make sure there's a link on our site, too, so
Great.
People have it.
Yeah.
All
thanks
right.
so much.
Jay, thanks so
it.
Much. Great
Thank
talking
you,
with you.
Good talking to you, too.
Stopping you from becoming a Catholic.
Why can't women become priests?
I don't understand why I have to earn salvation.
How is it possible that God created everything?
Why do I need to confess my sins to
why
a priest?
Why is the Catholic Church so unwilling to
The Catholic Church is too rich.
Catholics worship Mary and are committed.
As far as I'm concerned, all religions are equal.
You are called to communion with Dr. David Anders. Tonight, 11 p.m. Eastern, on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
We recently won an important case in federal court in Toledo, Ohio. For too long, city police officers were enforcing local and state laws to prohibit pro-lifers from engaging in free speech activity on the public sidewalks outside of a local abortion center. In our case, the court issued an order prohibiting the city and its police officers from enforcing any local or state law as applied to the expressive activity of pro-life demonstrators, including our clients. This is yet another victory for the First Amendment in a case where a city and its police officers were abusing their authority to silence peaceful pro-life demonstrators to appease those engaged in the baby-killing business. As the court's order demonstrates, the Constitution protects our clients' pro-life activity from such abuse. The government has no authority to silence our clients' speech simply because they are preaching the gospel on a public sidewalk next to an abortion center. Indeed, this victory is yet another blow to the abortion industry, which has too often relied on the government to promote and support its bloody business by silencing those who oppose it. The actions of the city of Toledo and its officers in this case were deplorable, and they violated our clients' fundamental rights. We stop this egregious activity in Toledo, and we intend to stop it wherever it raises its ugly head. I'm Robert Muse, co-founder and senior counsel for the American Freedom Law Center, bringing you this Faith and Freedom Minute. You can learn more about the American Freedom Law Center and its fight for your faith and freedom by visiting our website and liking us on Facebook.
There was no single event. It was more gradual. You know, eventually you just don't go one Sunday, and then you don't go two Sundays in a row. Then went through a divorce and ended up being a single parent. If I didn't have church or God, I would be back at that lonely stage, that trouble stage. Whenever you get anxious and worry about things, you just know that Jesus has it under control.
If you've been away from the Catholic Church for any reason, visit CatholicsComeHome.org.
Cresta in the Afternoon is underwritten by the following nonprofit organization, Real Estate for Life. Buying or selling your home or business property? Real Estate for Life can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 80% of the referral check to Ave Maria Radio and Students for Life. More information at realestateforlife.org or 877-LIFE-US1. That's realestateforlife.org. Underwritten in part by this not-for-profit.
Have you heard about Lord Teach Me to Pray? Lord Teach Me to Pray is a prayer series based upon the spiritual exercises of St. Ignatius of Loyola.
Training retreats will be held this summer and fall in various parts of the country. Go to LordTeachMeToPray.com to find a training retreat near you. In this exciting time of the new evangelization, the best way we can share the faith is by strengthening our own relationship with the Lord Jesus.
Lord Teach Me to Pray is sure to be transformative.
Go to LordTeachMeToPray.com and click on Facilitator Training Retreats.
This program is brought to you in part by the nonprofit St. Paul Street Evangelization. St. John Paul II stated that for the disciple of Christ, evangelization is a duty, an obligation of love. And the Catechism of the Catholic Church states that evangelization is necessary for salvation. So we know we're called, but how do we do it? St. Paul Street Evangelization can help. To learn more, contact us at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
And good afternoon to you. I'm Al Cresta. Does the idea of limited government find its root in the Jewish tradition? What does the Bible teach about the nature and scope of the state? What have rabbis, what attitude have they adopted towards political authority through the centuries? And what, if anything, do the answers mean for the modern state of Israel and for the political participation of Jews in America and other Western democracies? Well, joining me right now to talk about this is Dr. Daniel Mark. He is immediate past chairman of the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom and assistant professor of political science at Villanova University, where he's a faculty associate of the Matthew J. Ryan Center and battalion professor for the NROTC unit. For the 2017-2018 academic year, Daniel was a visiting fellow in the Tocqueville program at the University of Notre Dame, and it's great to make your acquaintance. Thank you.
Thanks so much for having me here.
Let's talk a little bit about Jewish tradition and regarding government. Most of our listeners are Catholics, so with not much understanding, I mean, we read the Old Testament, but not much understanding of the range of debate within the Hebrew and Jewish tradition. So I would imagine there's a long-standing chain of reflection on the role of the state, given the history of the Jewish people going back, you know, to the children of Abraham.
Well, it's interesting you put it that way, the right way, I think, in terms of the range of debate. And the answer to your question is kind of that there is and there isn't. So in one way, there is a very long tradition of debate, discussion, insofar as that you find in the sources, whether that's the Bible or the rabbinic sources that come later, all kinds of stories and laws that are relevant to this discussion. What you don't have is you don't have a systematic philosophical or theological tradition. So there isn't an Aquinas and there isn't a catechism in exactly that way. And so when we talk about Jewish political theory, Jewish views of the state, it's kind of thinking what the overarching theme is from the sources, because, you know, the devil can quote scripture for his purpose, right? So anybody can cherry pick verses for any view they want when it comes to looking at the Jewish tradition writ large, which is such a wide ranging set of works. But as far as thinking, well, what's the overarching theme? What's the underlying message of the whole thing? What's the main thrust of it?
Is the state in and of itself, is the state viewed as a divine institution?
Well, that's a great question, and it, again, it both is and it isn't. And so, but I'll really get to what the main point here. So on one hand, Jews believe that the Davidic monarchy is something divinely instituted, yeah. right? God chose, of course, Saul as the first king.
Right.
And then when he rejected Saul's lineage, he chose David and his descendants for eternity. And Jews still pray for the restoration of the Davidic dynasty. At the same time, we know that when the people of Israel came, the tribes came to the prophet Samuel and asked for a king, Samuel got angry and went to God, and God said, you think you're angry? How do you think I feel here? And that's because God said, well, wait a second, I'm the king. They're rejecting me when they ask for a king like all the other nations.
Right.
So on one hand, the Davidic monarchy is certainly divinely instituted. On the other hand, there seems to be what some have called the theological anarchy of the period of the Judges, where there was no king, but just the occasional leaders who rose up. Now, of course, that had all the problems you'd expect of instability and insecurity. And so the fundamental community is not the political community for Judaism, but the covenantal community. The people of Israel formed in covenant with God. And so after that, the state really seems like an instrument of supporting that and not something that's really the goal or the end point.
The experience of the covenant people in Jewish thought, to what degree is their experience applicable or transferable to the world at large?
Well, in what sense?
So we've got Davidic monarchy. So what we can learn from the Davidic monarchy is are there things from that that we can apply to a secular state?
Oh, yes, absolutely. And that's really the heart of what I'll be discussing today as well, which is that we might ask ourselves, well, what do we as modern people in the Western world, as small d Democrats, think about like praying for the restoration of a monarchy? And part of what the contributions of the Jewish tradition, the biblical tradition, and including, of course, the inheritance that Christianity received from Judaism, is thinking about the way the Bible conceives of the state. Now, the king, in a way, had powers of a king, as you'd expect in the ancient world, but was also limited. There was an absolute moral code. Remember that when David sins by having Uriah killed and taking his wife, the prophet Nathan, whom we've just named our newborn son after,
congratulations,
because we love this this lesson and this story, comes and rebukes him for violating God's moral law. It was not the pagan king, you know, with infinite power of life and death, so to speak. We also know that the institutions of the king and the priest and the prophet were divided, right? The high priest in the temple, the king in his palace, and then the prophet keeping the king in check. And people see these things as kind of proto version of limited government, thinking about the commands in the Bible that the king can't have too many wives or too much gold or too many horses, right? To limit his propensity to take everything for himself, to wage too much war, to overly burden the people with taxes and so on.
Yeah.
And all these things can kind of be ways that we can think about the Bible giving us early sources for the state not being total.
Yeah. Let me just pivot a bit on this and deal with divine promise. What's interesting about, I've heard a number of messianic Jewish people say, but also other Jewish people say, that there's a divine right to the land. Is that true? Is that a generally accepted position within modern Judaism?
It is definitely true that within modern Judaism, we continue to believe, I'm an Orthodox Jew, so I speak for a more traditional denomination, don't want to speak for the more liberal denomination necessarily, believe that God's promise of Canaan to Abraham and his descendants is a real promise, is absolutely true. Now, what's vastly, vastly disputed today, and obviously with the state of Israel, it's a very live issue, is what does that mean in practical political terms?
Right.
What does that mean in terms of the entitlement of any particular group of people today in the world to that piece of land, and by what means should that promise be realized? And you'll have the full range among Orthodox Jews, people who say that until God miraculously, and sending the Jewish Messiah miraculously restores the people to their homeland, until then there should be no political efforts and no state.
So the Zionist movement then was misdirected.
Oh, those people would think the Zionist movement was misdirected. I'm associating more as a Zionist, at least politically, and then further you have religious Zionists who believe not only which I would believe that, of course, it's appropriate for Jews to live in their homeland and to have sovereignty, but in fact, that there should be a political agenda of asserting sovereignty over all of that land as firmly as possible. And the point is just that it's extremely vexed and extremely disputed, but what's at the core agreement is that there is a real promise of God to Abraham of the land of Canaan, and then the debate is what does that mean for us today politically, and of that you'll find views of every kind.
I see. I see. So that within Orthodox Judaism, then, that promise to Abraham is settled. I mean, that's...
Yes.
And the question is, then, what does that mean? How do we look at this, the more secular Zionist movement of the 19th century? Was that the proper means? How does that then translate into norms for governing? So if you accept that the 1948, that's a move of God to restore the land to the Jewish people, then the question is, what are the ethical stipulations to properly rule and govern in the land?
That's exactly, I was hoping you would ask just that, because whether you are a political Zionist or religious Zionist or whatever other, something in between, the fact is that there is a state of Israel, and it is a Jewish state. The Israeli Supreme Court has controversially called it a Jewish and democratic state. And the question is, what does that mean, and how are those related?
Sure.
And although it is not a religious Jewish state in the sense that Jewish law does not make the civil law, Jewish law and Jewish tradition play a very important role in civil law, and there are some civil laws, unlike in the United States, that actually are under the direction of the rabbinate family law in terms of dietary restrictions. There are things that are actually regulated by the government-appointed religious establishment. And that, of course, hotly debated as well. Should we have more separation of church and state in Israel like we do in America, or should we have less? But the core, in terms of norms, the core thing to understand, which really brings us full circle to the original questions about Judaism and the idea of the state and limited government, is that what the biblical tradition gives us, true for Judaism and Christianity, I would say, as a break from the pagan tradition, is the idea of the individual human person created in the image of likeness of God. And the dignity that comes from being in the image and likeness of God, the moral agency that comes with that, is what requires the state to respect that person as a person and not to treat the person as all pagan empires did, as an instrument, as a piece that could be disposed. And for that reason, there must be the kind of government, and whether it comes slightly in one form or slightly in another form, parliamentary, presidential, whatever it must be a government that respects the dignity, the humanity, the agency of every person. And in the modern world, the only form of government that we know of that kind is small r republican government, government by consent, government by the people.
Yeah. Is it as amazing as it seems to me that the Jewish Christian tradition here of seeing the human person as made in the image and likeness of God, with a responsibility to image God and to have dominion on the earth or cultivate the earth or however you want to see that creative activity. I mean, is there any other parallel? Is there any similar parallel like that in any other world religion?
So I'm not an expert in the in world religions in general, so I don't want to speak out of school.
Fair enough.
I mean, obviously, Islam inherited a lot from Judaism and Christianity, regardless of what one thinks of Islam. Historically, of course, it's derivative of those traditions in certain ways. So maybe that's our closest bet. But either way, at least for the world we live in, for the Western world, what was, the Mesopotamian world, the Egyptian world, and the Greco-Roman world, and so on, all the way, back through Western civilization, the Bible was absolutely revolutionary and a whole range. But to recognize that really this fundamental idea of what the human person is changes the game on everything. It changes the whole game for the state, for our sex lives, for whatever it is, because it was such a fundamental idea. And this is the lesson of Moses and Pharaoh, and that you can't just throw the baby boys in the Nile, these are people who have whose lives mean something, and they're not just disposable pieces that belong to Pharaoh.
The Hebrew midwives, Was that an act of civil disobedience against Pharaoh?
It sure was. Yeah. A pretty brave one too, because obviously they could have risked their lives, and you know, they are great heroines, because through them, you know, the Jewish people were saved, right? They're the ones who made sure that the population would survive, and perhaps, you know, Moses was saved a different way. His mother secreted him into the Nile, of course, but presumably that was the backdrop against which an act of bravery and civil disobedience like that was committed too.
Can you stay with me a little longer?
Absolutely. Okay. Be happy to talk.
My guest, Dr. Daniel Mark, is the immediate past chairman of the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom. Again, taking a look at Jewish thought on the role of the state, its nature, its scope, trying to understand, again, this revolutionary idea of human persons made in the image and likeness of God and relevance for government.
Hi, I'm Al Cresta. Imagine 4 days of learning from and conversing with some of the Western world's leading thinkers, organizers, activists, and entrepreneurs. I'll be there at Acton University June 18th to 21st in Grand Rapids, Michigan, along with family scholars like Brad Berzer and Ryan Anderson, biblical thinkers like Scott Hahn, social critics like Father Robert Sirico, Jay Richards, Jennifer Roback Morse, and dozens more teachers and hundreds of learners like you. Learn more at university.acton.org.
Beth, why is our health insurance so expensive? Our premium and deductible are so high. Plus, I don't want my family to support a company that doesn't share our values.
Kim, there is another option. Check out CMF Curo. It's an affordable Catholic healthcare ministry where members share their medical costs in community, and it's pro-life. We joined last year and have saved thousands, all without compromising our values. Just go to MyCatholicHealthcare.com.
CMF Curo sounds exactly like what our family needs.
Yeah, that's MyCatholicHealthcare.com.
Hi, I'm Al Cresta. Join me, Teresa Tomeo, and Father John Ricardo for fun fellowship and beautiful weather during our Good News Marriage Cruise. Former NFL star Matt Burke will also be there sailing the Caribbean as we explore how to rejuvenate your marriage in Christ. We're sailing January 26th to February 1st, so call 855-879-6932. That's 855-879-6932. Or visit AveMariaRadio.net for early registration discounts.
Now, on the Ave Maria Radio app, the prayer section, where you can listen to the Holy Rosary. All four mysteries are voiced by Christ as the Answer and Father Knows Best host, Father John Ricardo. Are you struggling to remember specific prayers for pre- and post-confession, reciting the Stations of the Cross, or prayers during Eucharistic Adoration? It's all there, word for word, and within a few clicks under the prayer section on the Ave Maria Radio app. Download it on your smart device today.
Christianity is not inherently pacifist. The Hebrew word for kill, as in thou shalt not kill, is ratzash, which means murder. Our Lord himself compares the military chain of command with the faith of the centurion, whom he praises, in Matthew chapter 8, verse 10. The Catechism of the Catholic Church lays down the conditions for a just war, starting in number 2308. In Luke 14:31, the Prince of Peace tells a parable in which a king is advised to make sure he's ready before taking on a larger army. In Luke 22:16, he tells his apostles, in effect, to bear arms. He says, "Let him who has no sword sell his mantle and buy one." And who's more peaceful than Jesus? Let's pray for our military men and women overseas and for our brave law enforcement professionals here at home. This is Patrick Coffin of PatrickCoffin.media. Be a saint. What else is there?
Dr. Ray Guarendi.
What's the definition of frustration? Frustration is the difference between the way it is and the way you want it to be. It's hard to change the way it is. The way it is sometimes is other people, life, circumstances. The way you want it to be is in your power to change. You can close the gap between reality and what you want. The smaller that gap, the less your frustration. It is always easier to change oneself than to change reality. Frustration isn't always what happens out there. It is how we look at what happens out there.
afternoon. I'm Al Cresta, thanking you for joining me. We are in Grand Rapids, Michigan for the annual Acton University, and I'm speaking with Dr. Daniel Mark, who is the immediate past chairman of the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom, assistant professor of political science at Villanova University, and talking again about Judaism, of the state, limited government. I would imagine within Judaism you have analogs to, you know, all the various political positions that you find in mainline American culture. So you have conservatives, you have more liberals, you have more left wing, right? I mean, don't you have that? You got, quote, moderates.
Sure. I mean, you're going to have people of all kinds. You know, they have a famous joke, two Jews, three synagogues.
Yeah.
So we're not unknown for our ability to disagree with each other.
Right. Yeah. What is distinctive about... So, for instance, you're an Orthodox Jew. Where do you end up in the American political spectrum?
Got it. Yeah. Absolutely. So I'm glad you bring that up, too, because I should have mentioned before that we've got 2,000 years of rabbinic tradition, a biblical tradition that goes back further. But it's interesting, as far as we think about politics in the state, that the 2,000 years of rabbinic development, which really parallels the development of the church in a lot of ways, chronologically, but also
interesting,
but also in kind of the way in rabbinic Judaism and the Catholic Church really emerge as institutions right around in the early centuries of the first millennium.
Right.
But what's interesting for the Jews at that time, unlike the church, is that it was a stateless Judaism, right? So after the destruction of the temple by the Romans in 70,
that's right.
All the way until 1948, when the state of Israel is established. Again, not as a religious Jewish state, but let's say a Jewish state nonetheless.
Mm-hmm.
The rabbis were forming Jewish law and the Jewish codes without any kind of sovereignty. And so they have a really interesting relationship to politics, which sometimes is just not particularly interested in politics. Sometimes it's kind of utopian. Sometimes it's just very hard-headed and practical in the sense of, we're under someone else's sovereignty,
right,
and we
got
to think about politics. And so what you don't have in Judaism is a developed view in the 2,000-year tradition of rabbinic Judaism, a developed view of Jewish politics and Jewish sovereignty, which connects back to what we said before of finding it kind of between the lines through all kinds of stories and laws and seeing what the bigger picture is. So what that means is... Jews are kind of in a new stage of thinking about Jewish politics since the foundation of the State of Israel, and since in the 20th and 21st century, since the coming into politics of Jews in America. Let's say now, of course, Jews, though a small part of the population are influential. Well, the way things have sorted out, especially in the past 100 years, is that Jews in the United States are overwhelmingly liberal, overwhelmingly vote Democratic.
Mm-hmm.
What's interesting is that for Orthodox Jews, of the three main denominations called Orthodox, Conservative, and Reform, going from most conservative to most liberal, the names are really confusing. Of those three, the Orthodox, which are the most religiously traditional, won't be surprised to hear that are also the most politically conservative.
Yep.
Now, that doesn't mean they are mostly politically conservative, but on average, they are more. And so as a share of the Jewish population in America, though, Orthodox Jews are a small share. But like with you would expect, we see the same thing with the Christian community of America, the Orthodox share, small O or big O, Orthodox share is growing because among liberal Jews, you have both lower birth rates and higher assimilation.
Yep.
And
yep.
So whereas for a very long time, Orthodox Jews were maybe 10% of the American Jewish population, they're increasingly reaching something to close to 25%, like a quarter of the American Jewish population. And those trends may very well continue, even as, I should say, the overall size of the American Jewish population has stayed the same. Orthodox Jews, which are the most religiously traditional, as I said, are also the most politically conservative and are growing as a share of the Jewish population.
It is interesting that the Jewish people have not had the project of having to govern.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, when you don't have to govern, you can develop critiques that may be utopian, because you're not responsible for them. But you can also live, Republicans sounded this way to me,
you know, they were very good at critiquing, but they were very bad at governing.
Yes.
Now they're maybe maturing a bit. But what kind of cooperation do you envision between politically conservative Catholics and evangelicals and Orthodox Jews?
Well, I'm one of those people who really favors a strong political, cultural, social alliance, not a theological alliance,
right,
of course, because we have differences that can't
be
bridged. I think we should be friends anyway.
Yeah.
Now, it happens to be that on the issue of the state of Israel, I think Jews who are still Zionist, and unfortunately Zionism is on decline among liberal Jews, unfortunately, but for the Jews, for the majority of Jews in America who still care about the state of Israel, who still care about Zionism, they have to recognize that conservative Christians in America are the best friends Israel has in the world, and the most politically potent force in the world, because, of course, America is the most politically potent force in the world. And so I think it's really, really short-sighted and self-defeating for Jews to reject Christian and especially evangelical support of the state of Israel. I think there's all kinds of bad reasons why Jews are worried about that, and
right,
I think they're wrong.
Right.
But I would like to say more broadly that I think, and this is not as popular a view among Orthodox Jews, but I think that Orthodox Jews, that Jews in general, have a responsibility for their own society in America. The Orthodox Jews living in America, sometimes there's a tendency to say, well, let's make sure that the values inside our community are strong, and if things aren't looking so hot outside the community, well, that's not really our problem. Now, it's understandable. There's a lot of reasons. After 2,000 years of persecution, it's understandable for Jews to kind of want to keep their heads down and tend to their own pastures. But I think the Jewish mission, I think the idea of Jewish chosenness is to carry God's moral law into the world. And I think that it's quite obvious that the culture wars today mean, the shape of the culture wars today mean that small o Orthodox believers across a variety of faiths need to help each other defend traditional religious values that we all share, and that the same challenges to our faith, to our beliefs, to our religious liberty that are coming for one group are coming for, as it's today is your church, tomorrow it's my synagogue, and so on. And so I think it's really important that we build a strong alliance, and concerns about, you know, the past and so on really need to be left behind.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I agree. I think that's great. And I find, for instance, within Catholicism right now, those who are, you know, committed to the faith, not nominal Catholics, are having to rethink what it means to be Catholic in America, because some of the institutions and concepts that we used to take for granted are no longer operative in modern America. And trying to figure out what to do about that, to what degree do we turn inward and, you know, basically shore up our parishes so that they're believable centers of, you know, prayer and healing. To what degree should we be active in, you know, the culture wars?
That's right.
So
and in my line of work, I'm sure it's come up on your show, but we debate the Benedict option endlessly.
Yeah, all the time.
You know, ultra-Orthodox Jews are kind of have perfected the Benedict option. They did years ago, right? They just want to be as insular as possible, up the walls as high as possible, and say, we will engage with the outside world only insofar as it's absolutely instrumentally necessary. And I think that's both a theological mistake and a strategic mistake. It's a theological mistake for the reason I said before.
It actually forgets the Jewish mission.
That's right.
Right.
And I think what I would interpret as the Christian mission as well. And even further, because for Christians it's actually to evangelize and convert.
Right.
For Jews it's just stay where you are but obey the moral law. And so, it's an imperative, I think, both for Jews and Christians. But I think it's a strategic mistake. I think it's obvious that where we are now in the culture wars, they're coming for you. There is no saying, well, you know, the quote unquote libertarian compromise. Okay, you do your thing, we'll do our thing. I just don't think that's a tenable, sustainable position anymore today. And so I think that we need to engage, and we need to now. I respect the idea that we have to. I say modern Orthodox Jews like me, we kind of have the Benedict option light. So we, unlike Catholics, we did not shift from sending our kids from parochial schools to public schools. They're still in parochial schools.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's important. They're still in parochial summer camps. They're still in, you know, and that stuff is critical. But that's different, obviously, than retreating behind the fortress walls.
Right, right. Yeah, I think the important thing is we may have a certain make sure we have an awareness of being a distinct community, even though we have a world mission. We've got to retain our identity.
And fiercely protect the education and influences of the children.
Absolutely, absolutely. Tell me about your work on the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom.
Sure. Well, I had the great privilege of being appointed in 2014. Sir, by then Speaker John Boehner was reappointed for my second two-year term by Speaker Ryan in 2016, maxed out with my two-year terms. Mm-hmm. And it was really a great privilege to serve. This is a federal agency, USERF, as we call it for short, that responsibility is to monitor the worst abuses of religious freedom around the world and to make recommendations to our government in Washington of how U.S. foreign policy can promote religious freedom. And this is such an important thing. Obviously, religious freedom is in our values. It's who we are as a people, but it's also in our interest. We see more and more that religious freedom in countries is correlated with peace, prosperity, stability, and so on. It's a great thing to be able to say American values and American interests are perfectly aligned here. And so this body, it's just 9 appointed, part-time, unpaid commissioners who come in and work with a full-time staff and full-time policy staff in Washington to help make recommendations to our government, got to travel to all kinds of interesting places, got to make recommendations to our government, and to really, in a way, also hold our own government's feet to the fire. Yep. You know, when the State Department does its work, they've got political priorities, economic priorities, military priorities, all kinds of things. And we have to be there to say every day, well, you know, if our president is going to talk to the president of China, if we're going to do a military deal with Pakistan, we got to make sure that religious freedom is at the top of that agenda for discussion.
Get rid of those blasphemy laws or whatever.
Amen.
In your read of the situation, is it possible that Islam, being faithful to itself, can ever recognize a Jewish right to the land?
I don't know. It's a tough one. I think to the extent that this is a political question, not a theological question, I think the answer is yes. I think it's the same way. Can Islam recognize religious liberty for others? There needs to be what friends of mine and great scholars have called a resourcement. So we're not going to call it a reformation, but a resourcement, which is to say, to go back to the Islamic sources as Judaism has, as Catholicism had, and discover, I mean, obviously, you know, Dignitatis Humanae was a key moment the church didn't promulgate something new, but the church clarified and expanded on deep truths built into the tradition on religious liberty. Judaism has developed sources in that way, and Islam needs its turn
needs its
Dignitatis Humanae.
Well, thank you so much, Daniel. How do people stay in touch with the work you're doing?
Although I've been term limited out of the commission, USERF.gov is a great thing to do. And then, of course, you can always find me on the Villanova website. I'm in the political science department. I've got an email address there if people want to be in touch with questions. And hopefully I'll have more articles for people to read and books for people to buy in the future.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Yeah. Great to talk to you.
Dr. Daniel Marek, again, immediate past chairman of the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom, and assistant professor of political science at Villanova University. I'm Al Cresta.
What does the 10th commandment condemn? When the Lord God told us not to covet our neighbor's goods, he denounced envy, avarice, and greed as the root of theft, robbery, and fraud. Greed, the Catholic Catechism tells us, is the desire to amass earthly goods without limit. Avarice arises from a passion for riches and the power that attends to their possession. He who loves money never has money enough, says the Roman Catechism. The 10th commandment also requires us to banish envy from our hearts, reminding us that the devil's envy of God brought death into the world. Envy is defined as sadness seeing another's goods, accompanied by the immediate desire to possess those goods. Note, our Lord placed being poor in spirit at the top of the list of his 8 Beatitudes. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
Christ is the answer, with Father John Ricardo.
I repeat, I'm sure ad nauseum to the guys who are here, a line from Pope Benedict Emeritus now, who used to say over and over again, to be a Christian is not the result of an ethical choice, but the result of an event, an encounter, a meeting with the living God in the person of Jesus Christ. This and nothing less is what it means to be a Christian. So we said the new evangelization is new in ardor. That's a kind of old-fashioned word. What in the world is ardor? Ardor is zeal, fervor, passion. Are you passionate about Jesus? Passionate about Jesus. Are you zealous for Jesus? Are you fervent for Jesus? Are we fervent for the gospel? Are we passionate about helping this world come to know him?
Good afternoon, I'm Al Cresta, thanking you for being with me. You can follow up on any of our conversations in this first hour by going to AveMariaRadio.net and just go to the Cresta Guest Archives. We'll have further information on socialized medicine and the work of Philip Booth. Also, Daniel Mark and his thinking about the origins of limited government and the Hebrew Scriptures' participation in that. That's available, of course, in our Cresta Guest Archive as well. There'll be information there to follow up on. Now, next hour, we're going to take on a topic which is very large and often very ill-defined. It's the question of Western civilization. The genius of Western civilization has been a unique synthesis of faith and reason, a championing of liberty, and yet today, liberty and faith and reason are under attack. My guest, Dr. Samuel Gregg, is the director of research at the Acton Institute, and he will be discussing reason, faith, and the struggle for Western civilization. You've heard, I don't know how many books discuss the decline of the West, and many of these books really have no hope for the future. Sam's book is very different in that respect. He believes that faith and reason provide a hope for the future. I'm Al Cresta. Stay with me.
This hour of Cresta in the Afternoon is co-produced by Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Cresta in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
With the New York Times in one hand and the Catechism of the Catholic Church in the other, Al Cresta is ready for conversations of consequence.
America is as divided as it has been in 150 years.
Politics is symptomatic of the culture.
They don't have a personal relationship with Christ.
We've been sacramentalized, but not evangelized.
Why should Washington listen to us when our own house is in disarray?
The Church's greatest riches are her people.
Share the contagious joy of being a friend of Christ.
Story after story after story of people who have had inexplicable healings.
Broadcasting from the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and taking a closer Catholic look at current events, issues, and ideas. This is Cresta in the Afternoon.
That's beautifully said, Al.
Thanks for your voice for liberty.
It's like a homecoming each time on your program.
Clear to me that you've thought these things through at a deep level.
Let's build the church, and then we'll bless the nations. And a good afternoon to you. I'm Al Cresta. Thanks for joining me this second hour of Cresta in the Afternoon. We continue in Grand Rapids, Michigan at Acton University, where we are exploring the spiritual and moral foundations of a free and virtuous society. Sam Gregg is going to be joining me in just a few minutes here. And Sam is a great thinker. He's been on this program many times before. He's just published a book, not quite 200 pages, which I think is dynamite. It's Reason, Faith, and the Struggle for Western Civilization. Now, I have to say, since the mid, well,
since mid-70s, I would say. I've read I don't know how many books about the decline of the West, about the decline of Christianity in America, about the loss of a Christian foundation for America. And many of these books urge, of course, action. Very few of them have understood the unique role of faith and reason together. Many of those books that I'm referring to talk about we have to get back to the scriptures. Very few of them take a hearty Catholic understanding of the role of right reason and its synthesis with authentic faith. Sam does that, and consequently, the book ends up looking at all the mess, but it is also a book of extraordinary hope. We're going to go back and we're going to look a little bit at the relationship between the Hebrew scriptures, the understanding of wisdom, God's orderly creation, and how the Hebrews were a people far more given to exalting wisdom and reason than even the Greeks. It's a wonderful insight that Sam has. And of course, this gets mediated to us through the church and with the great peak of faith and reason, the great synthesis of Thomas Aquinas. But before we get started on this, let's get today's headlines.
Thank you, Al, and good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Friday, June 21st. It's the memorial of Aloysius Gonzaga. And today's news is brought to you by Charity Mobile, supporting pro-life and Catholic causes at charitymobile.com. President Trump is talking about his thinking before calling off retaliatory airstrikes against Iran. During an interview for NBC's Meet the Press, Trump said a plan was ready to go, subject to my approval.
And things would have happened to a point where you wouldn't turn back or couldn't turn back. So they came and they said, sir, we're ready to go. We'd like a decision. I said, I want to know something before you go. How many people will be killed? In this case, Iranians.
He noted that he pulled back after military officials told him there would be about 150 Iranian deaths at three designated sites in Iran. Trump said he didn't think it was proportionate to shoot down an unarmed drone. Iran shot down an unmanned U.S. military drone over the Straits of Hormuz this week. U.S. immigration officials will reportedly start conducting massive roundups of migrant families on Sunday. Several reports say ICE agents are targeting up to 2,000 families that have been slotted for deportation in several big cities. The cities include Los Angeles, Chicago, Miami, and Houston. And a new study shows that smartphones may be linked to horn-like structures growing on the inside of people's skulls. The Scientific Reports study found bone spurs on the base of skulls of around 400 adults. Bone spurs occur when inflammation damages the cartilage and the body tries to repair it by growing more bone. The study resurfaced after BBC published an article last week on how modern life is transforming and changing with technology use. Scientists say extensive screen time, bending the head down for extended periods of time, and poor posture may be the cause of the physiological change. With your Ave Maria Radio News, I'm Dan McGraw.
Good afternoon, I'm Al Cresta. You know, we all have a desire, I think, to be properly oriented. We know there's been a long past to our culture, our society, and we know that there's an indeterminate future. We're trying to figure out, well, where are we in the grand sweep of things here? We've got rises of ideologies that have been hostile to the Catholic faith. We have changes in political structure. We have the proliferation of rights. We have generally a very polarized situation in the United States at this moment. My guest, Sam Gregg, has written an outstanding book, which gives a good running start and brings us up to the present day. It's called Reason, Faith, and the Struggle for Western Civilization. Sam is research director here at the Acton Institute in Grand Rapids, and he writes regularly and speaks on questions of political economy, economic history, ethics and finance, natural law theory. He holds a doctorate in philosophy and moral philosophy and political economy from the University of Oxford. And as I said, his most recent book, Reason, Faith, and the Struggle for Western Civilization, it's the most exciting thing I've read in the last 2 years.
Oh, Al, that's very generous of you.
I really love it.
Either that or you need to read more books.
Well, I'll tell you what I liked about it, and I'm still working through the whole thing, but there are many, many books out there that track what they believe is kind of the woeful decline of Christian influence in society. Mm-hmm. And the general impression is that it's all downhill from here. Your book doesn't take that approach. It looks at the grand sweep of Western intellectual history, economic history, political history. But you're focused on the synthesis of faith and reason, one of the grand accomplishments of the High Middle Ages, and that wasn't left in the High Middle Ages. There still is, within the Catholic tradition, a beautiful synthesis of faith and reason. So you have, it's a book of hope, not a book of decline, and I'm sure that was intentional.
Yes, it was, because, as you say, there's plenty of books and materials out there saying that we're all going to Hades in a handbasket, that the West is inevitably going down this path of internal disintegration, etc. And you look around the world and you say, well, there seems to be a fair amount of evidence for that. But one of the things I was trying to do is to say that decline is not inevitable. Decline is something that you ultimately choose, and that if the West wants to be the West, then it has to recover this unique synthesis of reason and faith that really it starts at the period of the emergence of Christianity and achieves a type of apotheosis, as you said, in the High Middle Ages. And then things start to happen, a type of disintegration starts to happen. But that synthesis of reason and faith, I think, is so deeply woven into the very nature of the West that even if we try to purge it, we can't really quite do it on a lot of levels. And we know this because whenever the faith-reason synthesis starts to break down, what we end up is what I call these pathologies of faith and pathologies of reason. A pathology of faith would be something like Marxism. Marxism, if you look at it, is very deeply religious character.
Deeply eschatological.
Right, yeah. Absolutely. It has its own church, communist party. It has its own sacred books, the books of Marx, Engels, and has its own saints like Guevara, etc. Yeah.
Redemption by the blood, class warfare.
Absolutely, absolutely. So, and that's all terrible. All that is very terrible stuff. And you find the same in the world of reason, that reason, when it's detached from contemplation of higher things, rapidly degenerates into things like we value the scientific method and we reduce reason to the scientific method. So, but all those are pathologies, and because they're pathologies, they point back to what is healthy, what is good, what is right, how these things should be related to each other. And I guess the impetus for the book comes from Benedict XVI's Regensburg Address, which is where the book really begins. Right. And it points out that on one level, yes, that speech was about some of the cultural problems faced by Islam right now. And there are plenty of Muslims who will tell you Benedict was absolutely right in his analysis of this. But that speech wasn't really, in the first place, about Islam. That speech was about us. If you read it carefully, it's about us in the West. And the thing that you find about Joseph Ratzinger over his entire history is that he's always looked at this relationship between faith and reason as critical to the West. He's also taken the Enlightenment very seriously. It's really interesting when you read his work that he really begins with serious reflection upon this movement of ideas we call the Enlightenment, which began in the late 17th century and continued all the way through the 18th century. It was highly influential in the formation of the United States. And Benedict's take on the Enlightenment is that there's bad stuff, but there's also a lot of good stuff here. And he also points out that, so I wanted to explore more of that. I wanted to look at this history and say, what's going on here? And what you discover is that the relationship between Christianity and the Enlightenment, between faith and reason, is much more complicated. It's not all negative. In fact, there's a lot of positive sides to it as well. And if that could occur in the 18th century, why can't that occur in our own time?
Right. I love that you start with the Regensburg lecture and the frenzy that occurs after it, which in a sense kind of made the point of the lecture. I wish he hadn't backed up. He backed up a little bit from it. But he's really asking, is God a reasonable deity?
Yes.
And there's reason to question that within Islam, because
as many Muslims themselves will tell you.
They will. They will. I mean,
they will themselves will say, this is a genuine problem we have.
That's right. And he wanted to get at that, but he was real, as you say, he was focused more on the West's loss of confidence in reason, I think. And would you say, well, actually, I know that you would say, that the West, this unique integration of faith and reason, is part of our DNA?
Absolutely. In fact, I basically argue that without the synthesis of faith and reason that took place in the West over a long period of time, our civilization would be utterly different from what it is. It would be deeply irrational. It would be mired in paganism. And one of the things I point out in the book is if you go back to the early history of Christianity, is that Christianity is very much the religion of reason. It's the religion that takes reason very seriously. It takes truth very seriously, which is why educated Greeks and Romans were so attracted to it, and also why Hellenized Jews were so attracted to it as well. And so I think that Christianity takes reason so seriously that it even talks about God as the Logos, Logos meaning divine reason. Now, for Christians, God is love, God is divine justice, but God is also divine reason. And this is what this word Logos means. And when you understand God as having the qualities of being a reasonable deity, that changes your perspective on everything. And interesting, I point out that it was really the Jews who came to this conclusion. Mm-hmm. The Jews were the first people to come to this conclusion because they looked around at the world and they said, this pagan world with all its strange gods and they're all fighting each other and copulating with each other and making humans' lives miserable, etc., this just doesn't make any sense. And the God of the Hebrew Scriptures, he's a tough God, and he's sometimes hard to understand, but there's no question that he's a just and he's a reasonable God as well. And that made a vivid contrast with every other religion.
By word and wisdom.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. And Christianity takes this and universalizes it. And that's why, and it's interesting because, as I say in the book, you had these Greeks who were working out things like mathematics and physics, etc. But the big problem for them was their religion. Mm-hmm. Because all these marvelous intellectual achievements that they were realizing just were impossible to reconcile with the pagan religions, because the pagan religions were deeply irrational.
That's
deeply
right.
irrational. And people like Aristotle and Plato and Socrates, they sort of say this. They sort of imply, they have these sort of mild criticisms they make of the Greek religions.
Right.
They don't quite come out and say it, but it's very clear that they see the disparity in Christianity. And they were, many of these people were attracted to Judaism because Judaism had a much more reasonable conception of God mm-hmm. and therefore of the universe. And Christianity comes along and you don't have to deal with the particular rituals and ways of being of the Jewish people. But the Jews' emphasis upon God as the creator and this rational deity, Christianity universalizes, and this was very attractive to Greeks and Romans. It made sense to them.
Luke Ferry, the atheistic philosopher, says that John chapter 1, the introduction of the Logos, who takes on human flesh, says it is one of the great landmarks in the history of Western thought, and that many of the pagans of the day thought it was insane, because even if they did have a belief in a logos of some sort, it wasn't personal.
No. In fact, they were the ones that were using this phrase logos, but it meant many different things to them.
Right.
And Plato sort of gets close to describing it in the way that the Jews did, but they're still not there. They're still not there. And Christianity comes along, and as you say in the first verse of the first of the Gospel of John, in the beginning was the Word, and the word used for word is Logos.
Right. Yep.
John uses this deliberately because he knows that Greeks and Hellenized Jews will know exactly what he's talking about.
What I want to do, too, is I want to take a look at what is the West, because I think there's a I use the term frequently, but when pushed, I'm not sure I know exactly where its boundaries are, culturally or geographically. So why don't we start asking that question? What is the West? When you say the struggle for Western civilization, who's in that?
Well, I talk about this right at the beginning because I say inevitably people will say, what's the West? Who's a Westerner? Where does the West begin? Has it ended, etc.? So I go through and say, well, you could say there's a geographical dimension to it, sort of North America, Europe. But that doesn't really work because there's clearly countries that are Western that are not in that geographical space. Is Chile not a Western country because it's in Latin America? Is Australia not a Western country because it's in the South Pacific? Is Israel not a Western country because it's in... No, these are all clearly Western countries. I even say things like it's possible for countries to take on aspects of Western institutions. A good example would be a country like, say, Japan, which modernized itself by adopting much Western technology and institutions. But I say in the book, no one would describe Japan as being a Western country, and Japanese people themselves would not say
that.
That's
right.
So I go through all these things, and I say maybe it's something to do with if you look at particular individuals, particular ways of thinking, particular culture, and there's no question that things like rule of law, conceptions of human rights, conceptions of constitutionally limited government, these are all achieve a type of apotheosis in the West, and we can identify these with the West. But in the end, I think what it comes down to is this particular emphasis upon reason as the reasoned search for truth, which happens in other civilizations. Right. There's no question about that.
Sure.
But the particular way and the particular form that that takes in this culture we call the West, that reasoned inquiry in search of truth and its relationship to the faiths of the West, Judaism, Christianity, and the Logos that these religions talk about, that, I think, is the essence of Western culture. You don't have to live in America to be part of this culture.
Right.
But these things, if you believe these things and you think these things are true and right and good, then you're in the West.
Sam, hold it there. Got to take a break. We'll come back on the other side. My guest, Dr. Samuel Gregg, author most recently of Reason, Faith, and the Struggle for Western Civilization. Again, this is one you've got to get. And actually, you might be surprised, it's only about 200 pages, roughly.
Right.
Yeah. So we'll be right back.
Father Benedict Groeschel.
I usually am operating on the gifts of the Holy Spirit when I don't feel well, even when I'm annoyed, when I'm down and out. During my recovery from an automobile accident, immense numbers of people wrote to me and sent me emails, 50,000, and they told me how helpful they thought my talks on EWTN were to them. I'm delighted, but I want you to know I'm nobody's fool. The talks that were helpful, the sentences that were helpful, the phrases that were helpful came from the Holy Spirit. That's the work of the Holy Spirit, and the styrofoam packaging came from me. I did that. And styrofoam doesn't amount to very much.
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
What is prayer? The Catholic Catechism defines prayer simply as the raising of our mind and heart to God. Humility is the foundation of prayer. When we pray, do we speak from the height of our mind and will, or from the depths of a humble and contrite heart? It is only when we acknowledge that we do not know how to pray as we ought, are we then ready to receive the gift of prayer. St. Augustine points out that when we come to the well seeking water, Christ comes to meet us. He first seeks us and asks for a drink. His asking arises from God's desire for us. God's thirst encounters our thirst. He thirsts that we may thirst for Him. Where does prayer come from? Scripture most frequently cites the heart. If the heart is far from God, the words of prayer are in vain. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
I would always hear from different people at non-Catholic churches that Catholics were going to hell or that they really didn't know who the Lord was. The Catholic Church is not all what people say it is. I mean, it's completely different. There's so many stereotypes. It's very possible to know the Lord, and it's very possible to have a relationship with God in the Catholic Church. I believe I was born into the Catholic Church, and that's where I belong.
If you've been away from the Catholic Church, visit CatholicsComeHome.org.
Do you own popular index mutual funds or ETFs? If so, you're automatically owned shares of companies that conflict with your moral beliefs. Ave Maria Mutual Funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors can invest in the no-load Ave Maria Mutual Funds. The experienced professional portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and pro-life values. You can learn more about Ave Maria Mutual Funds today at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
Hi, I'm Al Cresta. Join me, Teresa Tamio, and Father John Ricardo for fun fellowship and beautiful weather during our Good News Marriage Cruise. Former NFL star Matt Burke will also be there sailing the Caribbean as we explore how to rejuvenate your marriage in Christ. We're sailing January 26th to February 1st, so call 855-879-6932. That's 855-879-6932. Or visit AveMariaRadio.net for early registration discounts.
Solidarity HealthShare began out of the Christian tradition of neighbor helping neighbor. They're a nonprofit medical cost-sharing ministry in which their members share in each other's eligible medical expenses. Solidarity HealthShare is not insurance, but rather an alternative way to pay for medical costs that adheres to the teachings of the Catholic Church. They'll never share in a medical care that goes against their values and morals, such as abortion, contraception, and sterilization. More information available at SolidarityHealthShare.org or at 844-313-4999.
And good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. We continue in Grand Rapids at Acton University 2019. With me, Dr. Sam Gregg, Research Director at the Acton Institute in Grand Rapids, and the author most recently of Reason, Faith, and the Struggle for Western Civilization. Sam, before the break, we were talking about what is the West. Mm-hmm. And when we talk about the West, we're thinking about, you know, constitutionally limited government, appreciation for faith and reason, value of liberty, rule of law, scientific enterprise rooted right in the high Middle Ages. Right now, there are many of our cultural elites that take all, I don't know what they do, I don't know what they think of all that stuff, but they seem to, when they talk about the West, they seem to think that the West is a catch basin for the worst of human impulses: racism, colonialism, mm-hmm, Eurocentricity, conformity, or people sometimes on the right will come at it and say, look what happened to the West, we're full of pornography, right, abortion, right, warmongering, irrational consumption. So why such what is it about certain elites that find it difficult to appreciate the virtues of their own society?
Well, the first thing I'd say is that, and I say this in the book, if you look at the history of the West, there's clearly some bad things.
Sure.
Slavery is a bad thing.
Right.
I say that the single most devastating event, which I think caused a lot of people, including some of the people you're describing, to really doubt whether there is anything to this Western civilizational project worth preserving, is the Holocaust. There's no question in my mind that
Take place in China.
Right. And I say, if you look at all these things, so who were the people who were implementing that? A lot of them were highly educated, upper middle class people with doctorates from a country which prided itself, Germany, which prided itself on its civilizational achievements. And yet these people ended up following this maleducated Austrian drifter and supporting and implementing the policies of a genocidal regime. So I asked that question, how could we end up like that? And I basically say that, so I say that it's very clear that this is this bad side of the West, and it's foolish to deny that. The question we have to ask is this consistent? Are these things consistent with the whole development of the West?
Right.
And my argument is that, no, these represent deviations. They represent pathologies of faith and reason. Marxism, I say, is a pathology of faith. Scientism, the sort of obsession with trying to use a scientific method to explain everything, that's a pathology of reason. So these things, these terrible things, the reason that we know that they're terrible things is because they're not consistent with the central tradition of the West itself. That's why we know they're bad.
Many people don't realize that the racism of Nazi Germany was, they tried to root it in racial hygiene and racial science.
Exactly.
They were trying to make an argument from science.
Right, and so that's an example of how some aspects of the National Socialist regime represented this sort of pathology of reason, because they tried to use science, what was called eugenics,
right,
and race science, which was adopted by large numbers of progressives in the United States, by
very
the way.
Much so. Yeah,
and I talk about that.
A lot of clergymen.
Absolutely.
Preaching eugenics.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Woodrow Wilson was deep into this sort of stuff. And my point is that these represent this is a pathology of reason, because it's using science to try and justify ideological positions. This is what this is about. So that's typically how I would respond to the type of people who are asking these sorts of questions.
Do those pathologies of faith and the pathologies of reason, do they lack, is part of the problem, they lack a transcendent justification? I mean, for instance, so the abuse of people that was common to National Socialism, is that because nothing is higher than the state?
Well, what happens, I think, is that when the synthesis of reason and faith breaks down, it doesn't mean that religion goes away.
Right.
It just means that what people believe in with a religious in a religious nature changes. So in the case of National Socialist Germany, religion weakens, its connection with reason weakens, and what happens is you have the race becomes the highest object of the good. Not God, not truth. The race becomes God. The race becomes truth. And everything gets subordinated to that. You see the same phenomena in Marxism. God goes away, but God gets substituted with something else. God gets substituted with Marxist ideology. And as we were talking about before, Marxism is remarkable, and I detail in this book in enormous detail just how similar it is to a religion, which tells us it's a pathology. So yes, I think that's what happens. Disappearance of a transcendent logos doesn't mean that people's natural instinct to know about religious truth goes away. They just start locating it in some very dark and dangerous places.
The eugenics movement that you mm-hmm. talk about, Harry Laughlin, who was a major mover and shaker in the United States, was given an award by Hitler's regime mm-hmm. for the eugenics law that he had crafted in the United States. We killed that thing, or not killed, we involuntarily sterilized, I think, 60,000.
Right.
The Nazis did about 300,000. And in what fascinates me in the United States is that so much of liberal religion, liberal Protestantism,
right.
Were at the forefront
absolutely.
Of urging a eugenics ideology. Mm-hmm. The only folks who stood against it were fundamentalists.
And the Catholic Church.
And the Catholic Church.
Absolutely.
And we actually, the Catholic Church was the one that was most effective because it took culture a little more seriously.
It also took science seriously
right.
as well.
That's
and
right.
the many Catholic theologians at the time were saying, this eugenic stuff is unscientific. It's just nonsense. So, but I do talk in the book, you mentioned liberal religion. I use that as an example of a pathology of a faith.
Yeah.
It's a pathology
yeah.
of a faith. And you can see how Newman, for example, talks about it.
That's right.
In the 19th century.
That was, and in one way, his whole career can be seen as the fight against
liberal religion.
He says
it himself in his famous Biglietto speech, which he gave when he was made a cardinal. He says, the consistent theme in my whole life has been the struggle against liberal religion. And in the book I talk about how liberal religion reflects the breakdown of the synthesis of faith and reason, because liberal religion tosses reason out the door.
Right.
And it substitutes reason with emotion and feelings, and my God is a nice therapeutic teddy bear. That's and so you can see there how the breakdown of the synthesis of reason and faith
and very along those same lines
mm-hmm.
All religions are essentially the same if they
absolutely,
generate
right.
that feeling of dependence
right.
or that warmth
right
feeling.
Right right so it's a you can see how it's a pathology
yeah.
because when you throw reason out the door, then suddenly you're not asking about the truth of a religion
right.
anymore. You're asking about, hey, does this make me feel good or what?
Yeah. There's still a lot of that today.
Absolutely.
In the United States.
In the Catholic Church, we find this mentality.
We find it here. Yeah, among fellow Catholics, we do see it. What was the reason that liberty became so central to the growth and success of the West?
Well, there's a number of reasons. I think it has something very clearly to do with Judaism and Christianity,
mm-hmm.
less so the Greeks. Now, people might be surprised by that, and I say in the book, well, what about the Greeks? How come, you know, wasn't it the Greeks who stopped the Persians from coming into Europe and
right.
subjecting us all to barbarism and tyranny? Yes, that's true. But the Greeks didn't have a strong conception of what Jews and Catholics call free choice. They did not have a strong conception of this because of their religion. Because in a world in which everything is, the religion is just sort of these gods who are doing these terrible things to each other and to humans, etc., etc., that people really aren't making free choices anymore. You're just being manipulated by forces around you. And that's pretty much how the pagan world saw things. We were surrounded by forces that were doing things with our lives that we didn't really know or understand. That's why they talked about fate a lot. You're just fated for this. You don't make any choices. Right. It's just, this is your destiny, etc. And Judaism is the first religion that says, no, there is free choice. I give you the choice between life or death, blessing or curse. Choose life that you may live. You find that nowhere in any other religion at the time. Christianity runs with that and says, no, we do believe that people can make these choices. Right. You can make a choice for Christ. You can make a choice against Christ. You can make a choice for God, against God. You can make a choice to sin or not to sin. There's good and there's evil, but you still get to choose.
I mean, the heart, Genesis 1, 2, and 3, the creation of the human in the image and likeness of God, male and female.
Right.
The command not to eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil.
Right.
It's all about what will you choose.
Right, and of course, part of the image-bearing capacity of humans that is talked about in the Hebrew and Christian scriptures, of course, is that God is free.
Yeah.
God doesn't have to do anything. This reasonable God, this reasonable creator, freely chose to set everything in motion. And if we are made in the image of this God, then we have reason and we have a free will. And you don't find that in the Greek world. You don't. As we were saying before, they're sort of struggling to get forward to this.
Yeah.
They sense it's there. But their stupid religions is really one of the things that's holding them back from appreciating this. And when Christianity comes along and universalizes this Jewish emphasis upon free choice, it's a game changer for the West.
Yeah, it's fascinating because they were bound by the idea of fate, weren't they?
Right,
and destiny.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And also in their world, the state had divine characteristics.
Okay.
Right? So, and I talk about this in the book, and this is one of the reasons why Jews and Christians were often suspected of being atheists.
right?
Because we did not, Jews and Christians respected the state, honor the emperor, etc., etc. The Jews worked out a whole arrangement where they would pray for the emperor, but not to the emperor.
Yep.
But Jews and Christians were viewed as atheists. Suspected of atheism because they were seen as not partaking of the public cults that would pay homage to the god of the city. Because if you didn't pay homage to the god of the city, terrible things were going to happen.
Well, and you were treasonous too.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah.
So Christianity, taking this Jewish emphasis upon freedom, if you want to understand why the West emphasizes freedom so much, it's very difficult to separate that off from its religious trajectory.
Yeah. Very good. Sam Gregg is my guest. Reason, Faith, and the Struggle for Western Civilization, the name of his most recent book. It's available in the online bookstore. I'm Al Kressel. We'll be right back.
Beth, why is our health insurance so expensive? Our premium and deductible are so high. Plus, I don't want my family to support a company that doesn't share our values.
Kim, there is another option. Check out CMF Curo. It's an affordable Catholic healthcare ministry where members share their medical costs and community, and it's pro-life. We joined last year and have saved thousands, all without compromising our values. Just go to MyCatholicHealthcare.com.
CMF Curo sounds exactly like what our family needs.
Yeah, that's MyCatholicHealthcare.com.
When the need for senior care arises, home is where the heart is. Visiting Angels provides home care for mom or dad up to 24 hours per day, including personal care, meals, and light housework. You may select your professional caregiver with Visiting Angels. More information at visitingangels.com or at 877-374-LIVE. That's 877-374-LIVE. Visiting Angels, America's choice in senior home care.
This program is brought to you in part by Charity Mobile, a proud partner of Ave Maria Radio for over 10 years. Charity Mobile is the pro-life cell phone company, and has sent nearly $2 million to thousands of pro-life charities. 4G LTE coverage is available nationwide, and 5% of your monthly plan cost goes to your favorite pro-life charity. A video introduction is available at CharityMobile.com. Charity Mobile, everyday living, effortless giving. CharityMobile.com.
Now, on the Ave Maria radio app, the prayer section, where you can listen to the Holy Rosary. All four mysteries are voiced by Christ as the Answer and Father Knows Best host, Father John Ricardo. Are you struggling to remember specific prayers for pre- and post-confession, reciting the Stations of the Cross, or prayers during Eucharistic Adoration? It's all there, word for word, and within a few clicks under the prayer section on the Ave Maria radio app. Download it on your smart device today.
Your worldview governs most everything else about your moral choices, your assumptions, and attitudes. It's the main premise behind your belief system. Worldview is the ethical air you breathe, or if you are a fish, the water you swim in. Think of how different the atheistic worldview is from the theistic one. If you believe there's no God and you're just electric meat with an extra bit of charm, there's no special plan for your life, and certainly no life after death, that's going to affect your daily decisions right down to your attitude to the alarm clock in the morning. If you're a Christian, then you're going to see everything in a very different way. Most people cobble together their worldview from the news, their friends, pop culture, maybe their school textbooks. What's your worldview? Can you sum it up in one sentence? Because it determines everything else. This is Patrick Coffin of PatrickCoffin.media. Be a saint. What else is there?
It's time for Family Man with Dr. Gregory Popchuk.
Did you know that using hormonal contraceptives significantly increases adult women's risk of depression and more than doubles the risk of depression for adolescent girls? New research by the University of Copenhagen found that hormonal contraceptives not only affect a woman's reproductive hormones, but impact her overall hormonal health in surprising ways that make it more difficult for a woman to effectively process stress in her body. That puts women who use hormonal contraceptives at much greater risk. In fact, up to an 80% higher risk for young women for serious mental health problems like depression. The good news is that natural family planning has been shown to be as effective as hormonal contraception without any negative side effects. Turns out practicing the church's teaching on sex is not just good to do, it's good for you. For more tips on the Catholic vision of love, check out my book, Holy Sex. I'm Dr. Greg Popchuk, but you can call me Family Man.
To discover more ways faith can enrich your life, visit CatholicCounselors.com.
Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta, talking here with Dr. Samuel Gregg, author most recently of Reason, Faith, and the Struggle for Western Civilization. Talking last segment about why liberty has become so really a central concern of the West. The idea of culture is related to the idea of cult.
Right.
So culture grows out of the cult, the what we worship.
Mm-hmm.
So what cult is at the heart of the West then?
In the past, of course, it was clearly what I call the two faiths of the West.
Yep.
From the emergence of Christianity, it's basically the cult is Judaism and Christianity. That's
yep.
That's absolutely clear. What's the cult now?
Right.
Well, obviously, the cultural imprint of Judaism and Christianity is so great, the West will never escape that. But what I would say is you have a variety of different cults now. You have what I call liberal religion. You have the viewing of science as almost the, sort of the ultimate arbiter of truth is another one. I think you also see liberty, but a liberty detached from truth.
More of a license.
Yeah, more than a license. And so what matters is I choose, not what I choose. Another part of this mixture is equality is sameness. By that I don't mean equality of dignity in the sense that none of us are subhuman, none of us are superhuman, we're all equal in dignity. But that's being replaced, I think, by equality as sameness. Equal starting point, equal ending point, and we keep think everything equal in between. So that's what's going on now. But if I was going to say what are the civilizational theses that distinguish the Western tradition, I'd say there's four. One is creation. There is a creator, there is design, there is purpose in the universe. The second, I would argue, is freedom. We've talked about that. Another one would be reason, this attention to reason and the importance of reason. Another is justice in the sense of you give to others what they are owed, and they give to you what you are owed. And the last one is faith. And by faith, I don't mean leap into the sort of the unknown. What I mean is the reasonable conclusion based on evidence, based upon putting our trust in what has been said and written down and repeated over time, that this claim about a particular religion makes about itself is true. So creation, freedom, justice, faith, all of which are sort of bound together with this conception of God as logos, and that human beings have reason as a consequence of being made in the image of God. If any of those things break down, you're in trouble. So if creation, the notion there is a creator and there is a designer, that goes away, then intelligibility disappears.
Right. If
intelligibility disappears, then we really can't say we're free. If our freedom goes away, then justice becomes just a matter of who is the strongest.
Yeah.
So keeping these civilizational themes together, I think, has been the genius of the West, and we know what happens when these things start to get separated or obliterated, or they have their definitions changed. There's flow-on effects to the other themes. So you take one theme away or you distort one of these themes, everything else gets changed.
Can you imagine the abolition of the slave trade or slavery without those things?
Right, because someone like Alexis de Tocqueville, who of course wrote so brilliantly about the United States and who struggled with faith his entire life, he was very clear that the abolition of the slave trade, it was partly an Enlightenment thing, but he also said it's very clear that slavery becomes incomprehensible the moment you accept Christianity.
Yeah.
So even at periods of history where Christians have tolerated and even participated in slavery, everyone had a sense that there was something problematic about this.
Yes,
even slave owners sort of had this sense there's something quite not right about
utterly
this.
Incongruous.
I don't
not
want to talk about
but
it, but I know it's not quite right.
Yep.
But the
yep.
pagan world had no compunctions about it whatsoever,
yeah.
because in their world, there are people who are superior by nature, and then there's everyone else who may be used and abused because they're weak.
You mentioned the Enlightenment again. I think it's good to go back to that idea, because most Christians, when they think of the Enlightenment, think immediately of, the French Revolution, the anti-clericalism, the anti-Catholicism of the French. They are not thinking that there was also an Anglo Enlightenment, which is really quite different in its appreciation for Christianity. And even there are Enlightenment thinkers, even in Germany and in France, who, they were not utterly opposed to Christian faith.
No. I mean, one of the things I say in the book is one thing I would like to hope the book helps to achieve is to help Christians to rethink what they think about when they hear the word Enlightenment or the Enlightenments. I say, for example, there's more than one Enlightenment. It's not this sort of monolithic thing. There's, as you said, an Anglo-Enlightenment. There's a Scottish Enlightenment, a French Enlightenment, a German Enlightenment. They're all somewhat different. It's also very clear that recent research over the past 100 years has shown that most enlighteners, as they were called, were not anti-religious. Most of them were believing Christians. Even in countries like France, where the anti-clerical thing took on a harsher tone towards the end of the 18th century, you had plenty of clergy who were participating in the scientific revolution, who corresponded with enlightened thinkers. So in the Catholic world that's going on in places like Scotland and the Scottish Enlightenment, where most of the Scottish Enlightenment thinkers, most of them were clerics.
Yeah.
Most of them were ministers of the Church of Scotland. One who I particularly admire, we mentioned him before, I think, is Thomas Rea,
yeah.
who's a
yeah.
reverend, the Reverend Thomas Rea. And you find this particularly in the United States, in the United States experience of the Enlightenment, where you have people like Franklin and Jefferson, who clearly are not Orthodox Christians.
Right.
But there's plenty of people who are participating in this SAVE movement who are Orthodox Christians.
That's right.
So my point is that the Enlightenment is something that we often see in terms of it's the Enlightenment versus Christians. That's what's going on. And one of the things I try to say is it's just much more complicated than that.
Right.
Were there bad things? Sure. But there's also a lot of good things as well. And I do find it remarkable when you read the writings of Joseph Ratzinger on some of these more philosophical and history idea subjects. He always starts with the Enlightenment, and his approach is not of hostility. His approach is one of critical engagement. He says there's good things going on here. He says he greatly admires the Anglo-American experiment. He says this on numerous occasions, and he says it's very different from some of the French Enlightenment experience. Now, if Joseph Ratzinger can have an appreciation for some of these very good developments and insights that the Enlightenment had, I think some of us should maybe think about how we talk about the Enlightenment when we're talking about it in the public square or with people who have, as you said, a highly negative view of the Enlightenment, because they think the Enlightenment equals cutting off the heads of priests and burning down convents.
Right. The recent bout we've had with the new atheists, many of them are going back to Gibbon's Rise, Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, and trying to make the argument that Christianity is an culturally enfeebling religion.
Well, this is Gibbon's thesis,
yes,
right?
Yes, exactly. So tell me about that. I mean, what's his argument and what's our response?
Well, Gibbon's, of course, just so you know, at one point he converted to Catholicism. He was a young student at Oxford. He converted to Catholicism.
Really?
His father made him go abroad and spend a year or so in Switzerland with a Protestant pastor. He converted back to, I guess, Anglicanism. But he basically, I think, was a skeptic.
Okay.
More or less a skeptic. And his argument in The Decline and Fall is that the whole decline of the Roman Empire happened for many reasons: incompetent emperors, over-bureaucratization, etc. But he says that Christianity basically weakened the ethos of the dominant elites. So they move from thinking about how do we secure the empire against barbarians. Instead, they spend their time arguing about obscure doctrinal points among themselves.
Right.
Or it encouraged pacifism. So people were no longer willing to go to war to defend the empire. You'd pay other barbarians to do it. And before you know, the barbarians have taken over. So, but he says that Christianity sort of enfeebled everything. He also has he didn't like the Jews very much either. He says that the Jews are sort of this highly irrational, stubborn people who resisted the sort of noble, tolerant views of the Romans, etc.
Impervious to reason.
Right, right. He says they're impervious to reason. Well, as we talked about before, not at all. The Jews were the people who really first come at a rich understanding of reason and free choice centuries before the Greeks.
Yep.
So that's the first thing. The second thing I say is that when you look at a Christianity, it actually produces a much more rational view of the religious world than anything that the pagans could have done. So that's a second factor. So the idea that Christianity encourages superstition, encourages feebleness of thought, etc. No, it actually toughened people's minds. So if you're looking for explanations for the fall of Rome, it's not Christianity. That's, if anything, some would argue that Christianity maybe even prolonged the existence of the Roman Empire long after it had reached its sell-by date, and that the fall of the Roman Empire had a lot to do with military factors, it had a lot to do with political factors, it had a lot to do with civil wars between emperors from about 150 onwards, etc. But Christianity in itself, no, it didn't really have that much to do with the fall of the empire. If anything, it probably sustained it longer than it should have, than it otherwise would have sustained for.
Looking at the current American culture scene, politics, its social engagement, the rise of a new interest in socialism.
Mm. Which is another type of religion.
Right.
It's a pathology of religion.
Yeah. And do you see a re-legitimizing of a Christian engagement with these opponents? Really, they've become, I think, opponents of the West.
No, this is a good point. I think that one of the things that Christians can do in this environment, believing Jews, believing Christians who take their religion seriously, is to, one, fight back against the narrative that we're having constantly pushed at us that, you know, you religions, you're irrational, you're superstitious. Yeah. We have to push back at this. No, you're the ones who are superstitious. Right. You're the ones who are fundamentally unreasonable. You're the ones who actually have these serious pathologies of faith and reason going on. So that's one thing. A second thing is we need to recover our own history, and this is one of the things the book tries to do, yep. is to say, look, if you want to understand the West, you want to understand its successes and its ability to correct its failures, it's almost impossible to get away from this synthesis of reason and faith that the two religions of the West have promoted so well for such a long period of time. And if we believe that to be true, then we will have confidence in who we are and what we say. Because what I see with a lot of Christians and believing Jews is a lack of confidence. We're sort of marginalized, we're pushed to the outer, you people are strange, we'll let you live in this particular way, but we're not going to let you participate in the public square. Okay. And I think that one of the ways that believing Jews and Christians can push back against this is to say, no, we actually take reason very, very seriously, so much so that we say our God has the qualities of logos, and you really don't have anything in terms of religion or philosophy that comes anything close to the synthesis of reason and faith that Judaism and Christianity have worked out over a long period of time. If we have confidence about that, and we speak about that, and we say that firmly, but with love, but firmly and clearly, then I think we have hope.
Yeah.
If we give up on ourselves, we have no hope. And one of the things I end with, I say at the book, we must have confidence. Decline is not inevitable. Decline is a choice.
Yeah. Sam, thank you so much. I love the book.
And, thank you, Al.
I'll give you a call on it again because I think
wonderful. Thank you.
Go through it. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Christ is the answer, with Father John Ricardo.
John chapter 11, verses 21 to 26. This is the story of Lazarus. Lazarus has died. Lazarus is one of his best friends. Just before this passage, we hear the news that Martha and Mary send word to Jesus that the one you love is sick. And the next line in the scripture is, now because Jesus loved Martha and Mary and Lazarus, he stayed where he was. His friend's in need. He can heal. They've seen him heal before. And yet somehow, because he loves him, he stays. And Lazarus dies. And then Jesus shows up 3 days later and is greeted by Martha and Mary, who confront him with the words, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would never have died. Rather applicable for many of us in our lives. We ask the Lord to do one thing because we're certain it is what we think is best, when in fact he has something which far surpasses what we asked for. Challenge is, in waiting for that to happen, we go through very trying times, which oftentimes makes us wonder, does he really care?
Dr. Ray Guarendi.
There's a simple step to raising a more grateful child. I used to say, easy, eliminate half of their material possessions. I don't say that anymore. That's ridiculous. I say 75%. They don't even miss 50. 22 stuffed animals, you go down to 11. Not exactly a hardship. Simple step to raising a more grateful child. Don't be so free with the material stuff. Research has shown more generous people, by and large, have less. You give a child less, he's more willing to share it. He also is more able to occupy himself with things like boxes and dirt balls and rocks, worms, stuff that doesn't cost a whole lot of anything.
Thank you so much. It's been good being with you. Let me remind you that you can follow up on all of our conversations by going to AveMariaRadio.net. And when you go there, go to the Crest of Guest Archives for follow-up information, for contact information. And always check the online bookstore for the books that we discuss on this program. In this case, Sam Gregg's extraordinary book, Reason, Faith, and the Struggle for Western Civilization. We have it available for you there. It's a book, in fact, that I'm going to be referring to, you know, now and then, for the next year or so, I'm sure. I want to stress again, though, while we're here at Acton University, that we are making sure that we lay out as much follow-up information as we can on each of these topics, because our guests have often provided great follow-up material. So just head on over to AveMariaRadio.net and check out the Crested Guest Archives. I'll see you next Monday, Lord willing, for another edition of Cresta in the Afternoon.
Cresta in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. To follow up on any of the guests or information presented on today's program, visit the Cresta Guest Archive at AveMariaRadio.net. That's A-V-E-M-A-R-I-A Radio.net. To listen to this or any other edition of Cresta in the Afternoon, visit the audio archives at AveMariaRadio.net. Or to order a CD of the program, call 734-930-4506 or email orders at AveMariaRadio.net. That's 734-930-4506 or orders at AveMariaRadio.net.